Welcome to the Exchange Podcast by EWL. As advisors to some of the most successful families in the country, Craig Emanuel, Tim Wyburn, and I, Ryan Lure, draw upon some of the best minds in the country. We believe that by exchanging ideas, we can deliver better advice and better outcomes for the families we worked for. Now, we're inviting you on this journey. In this podcast, we interview some of the country's best investment managers, business advisors, bankers, and founders to share their valuable insights. And our hope is that with better information comes better decisions, helping you to achieve more financially.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Exchange by Emanuel Wyburn and Lure. I'm your host today, Tim Wyburn, and today we have a very special guest all the way from Singapore in Benjamin Dumphy. Benjamin is the founder and managing partner at January Capital. January Capital is a venture capital firm based out of Singapore investing in the Asia-Pacific region and is Asia-Pacific's first dedicated diversified fund providing senior secured loans to leading growth stage technology companies managed by the region's most experienced venture credit team. Benjamin is responsible for overall portfolio construction and firm strategy at January Capital. Benjamin's track record of investments include Akaluku, Shopback, Go One, and Skadoolu. Benjamin was the only Australian in 2019 to be named as the member of the Forbes 30 Under 30 Venture Capital and Private Equity list. Prior to joining January Capital, Benjamin worked for Seabury Group, a leading advisory firm in New York, consulting on engagements across three continents. Benjamin was previously based in Southeast Asia as Vice President of Operations for Lazada, a billion-dollar e-commerce company now owned by Alibaba. Benjamin holds a Bachelor of Business from the Queensland University of Technology. It gives me great pleasure today to introduce Benjamin Dumphy from January Capital, a venture debt fund manager, relatively new to us and something that we've only been looking at in the last little bit. We spoke probably about 2 months ago when I had our initial call with you, and it was a fascinating discussion, so I thought we'd share that with some of the listeners today. So welcome.
Thanks for having me on, Tim. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Good to see you in the Brisbane office all the way from Singapore.
That's right, yeah.
I understand you're a Brisbane boy yourself.
I am, back visiting the fam, as you do.
Yeah. So it's probably good to start with just a bit of background about yourself, how you ended up in Singapore running a venture capital fund or a venture debt fund.
Sure.
And what interested you then in the first
place?
Yeah,
no, it's a good question. So I've been up in Asia now for more than a decade. What initially brought me up there was actually more on the operator side. So I was Brisbane born and raised, but had an opportunity in 2012 to go spend time working for at the time it was a fledgling startup called Lazada, which was really attempting to do last mile sort of B2C consumer facing e-commerce for the first time in Southeast Asia. And if you cast your mind back a decade, really there was no semblance of digital commerce in Southeast Asia. And so really we were sort of 100 people trying to figure out how to ship product, how to sell product online for kind of the first time. So I was based in Bangkok, but we were operating regionally. And was fortunate to sort of be there right at the inception of the digital cycle that we're seeing play out in Southeast Asia today. Fortunate that a lot of people I actually worked with have gone on to start pretty interesting businesses, and that sort of started to build the ecosystem. So in my time at Lazada, I was primarily looking at warehousing, logistics, sort of the less shiny, exciting stuff. And what I saw and observed was that despite there being this really pent-up demand from consumers, there just really wasn't the what you'd call digital infrastructure that was going to allow e-commerce to meet its full potential in the region. So to put that in context, we had 85% of deliveries going out were cash on delivery. So you really didn't know until you turned up at someone's doorstep whether you were actually going to get paid for it. So you had this crazy circumstance of delivery drivers driving around with 20 of the latest iPhones, really not even knowing if you're going to get paid for it. So these real issues that, you know, you could see that were quite clunky and were going to limit the full potential of the region. So I spent about sort of 12 months in that role and then thought I should probably go get a proper job, because whilst it was really fun, it was very much a startup at the time. Lazada's gone on and scaled quite phenomenally, more than I ever expected them to. So they do about $15 billion in GMV today, the majority owned by Alibaba. Spent a couple of years in the US in New York, had a good time there, and then came back out to Asia Pacific region in 2015 to start on the principal investment side with a mandate really to go and look at the gaps that existed in the sort of capital markets ecosystem for private markets in Asia. And the biggest gap that we identified at the time was growth stage companies just couldn't get funding from local funds. So there just wasn't funds of scale and size at that time, 8 years ago. And so that was the gap that we started to fill sort of originally from Australia, and then over time we've relocated up to Singapore. So a little bit about January and what we do. I think we've formally started the firm in 2019, but each of the founding partners have been investing in Asia for a considerably longer amount of time. And we've had the benefit, I guess, of seeing what other fund managers have done and how they've sort of built their own businesses, investing into technology companies and the broader sort of private equity landscape in Southeast Asia. And we've been able to pick off a couple of different strategies that we think, one, service the ecosystem, just don't have a lot of density of capital today. So we primarily play in institutional seed investing on the equity side, and then more recently on the growth credit side, which is what we've been speaking about recently as we've gotten to know each other. And that we think is fairly non-competed today. We don't see any dedicated funds actually playing in that space outside of us. And what we're looking to do is bring best of breed teams to go and capture that opportunity and work with founders in those respective strategies. That we've been able to scale the firm quite nicely through that. So today, managing in Australian dollars, about 400 million assets under management. As you said, headquartered in Singapore, 20 folks there full time, and really dedicated focus on Southeast Asia, and on a secondary sort of selective basis, still look at markets like India and Australia, just given the background and heritage of the team.
When you started in business all those years ago, did you always know that your pathway was going to go into venture and on the other side, or was that an opportunity you saw whilst you were in business? Or
I graduated university not really knowing what I was going to do, so I did what everyone that doesn't know what they're going to do does. It's either go into investment banking or consulting. I went into consulting. I think it was really that time at Lazada that helped really for me just put front and center the immense opportunity that was going to be ahead of the region. Both that opportunity, but also the challenges. And so I think it's really been this case of not necessarily having a plan up until probably the last 6 or 7 years, but it's sort of increasingly being clear that I was getting drawn into that opportunity. And so when I started 7, 8 years ago on the principal investment side, I was pretty clear that this is where I saw, the way to capture risk-adjusted returns for our investors, partially because there was just very few firms up there at the time doing what we wanted to do.
When we first engaged, I'd heard of venture debt. You don't hear much about venture debt, but I had heard a little bit, and you hear the horror stories. Well, not horror stories, but I think the sector in general has a bit of a bad reputation for kind of going in with really aggressive terms. Is there much competition in venture debt in Asia Pacific now? You said you started 8 years ago and no one else was doing it, but is there a lot more interest in it now?
So when we started 8 years ago and when we started the firm in 2019, we were more on the equity side. So yeah. Growth credit for us has been a more recent endeavor, and we sort of got pulled into it because on the equity side, we've got 50 plus companies, and the number one request we would get is, can you help us source credit? You know, can you help us source less dilutive financing as they scale their own businesses? And so we were sort of clear that there was very few players that were operating the space. And it was interesting to us because if you look at more developed markets like the US, you know, roughly 18 to 19% of all capital that flows into technology firms in that market is debt. It's not equity. It's an enormous business there, and there's actually publicly listed venture debt funds, the most famous of which was Silicon Valley Bank, which blew up not for its venture debt exposure, but more traditional banking issues. So when we started to get into it, we really saw that there was just a dearth of people doing what we thought was possible, which was the provision of less dilutive financing to companies that had scaled to a requisite level where you could really underwrite the risk from a credit landscape. I think where you hear less positive outcomes of venture debt, it's really the lending to smaller subscale companies. So companies that haven't really found deep product market fit, where you're lending less in terms of quantum of capital and trying to diversify it over a much broader base of portfolio companies. But I think of that as almost more equity-like risk than debt-like risk. The companies that we look at and the sort of initial deals that we've done in this sector are really companies, you know, that have often raised north of $150 million from global tier one funds that are often topping up from an equity standpoint at the time that we're investing. They have meaningful revenue, typically $50 to $100 million plus. And if they're not already, they're very close to EBITDA break even. So they've got a real tangible business. And so we can come in and really look at that opportunity and assess and underwrite the credit risk. But today, I mean, from a growth equity or growth credit standpoint, you really don't have a lot of people. You have the venture debt players, which traditionally play very early. And then you've got the more established private credit players that range from sort of regional firms up to the very large globals. But they're running billion-dollar plus funds. And so the interest of them in coming and doing a $10 to $20 million investment, which is typically where we tend to play, they won't really tend to look at things less than 50. And so it's just that gap that we see today structurally that we're looking to fill.
And specifically in Asia Pacific, or do you... US or Europe, or
specifically in Asia Pacific, if you run the numbers, you know, and we've got a pretty data driven approach across the firm, so we've got quite interesting empirical sort of proprietary data. There's over 650 what we'd call growth stage companies operating in the Asia Pacific region today. So that's core Southeast Asia, and we can include Australia in that equation as well. And in any fund vintage, we're looking to make between 20 to 30 loans. So the idea is that, you know, if we do our job well, we should really be able to source and unearth the most compelling opportunities and only really invest the top 5 to 10%. And I think if we were sitting here in 2021, you'd probably make the argument that, you know, with how cheap equity is, what's the reality of someone, how realistic is someone going to take on, you know, fairly expensive debt? I think obviously that's shifted quite a bit, and equity is now very expensive and not particularly available. And so, you know, we see even the best companies now, as they go out to raise a new round of financing or a pre-IPO, they're looking to senior secured debt as a way to sort of just give them the capital they want to go and accelerate growth. And so that's been a big shift that we've observed in the last 18 months in particular.
Before we get too far ahead into the discussion, can we just take it back a step and just define exactly what venture debt is? I know a lot of people listening might already know, but a lot of people might not.
Sure. The way we define it, and, you know, we're quite purposeful in that term of growth credit rather than venture debt, because, again, we're not lending to venture capital-backed companies. These are typically companies that have broken through and have growth equity, sort of equity participants on their capitalization table. But the way to think about what we do is the provision of non-dilutive or less dilutive financing. And the distinction there is whether or not we take warrant exposure as part of a loan. A warrant is effectively an option for us to purchase equity at some point in a predetermined period of time in the future at the strike price or the share price at which the time we came in and lent the company money. It gives us enhanced upside and reduces the amount that's actually payable back to us from a debt standpoint. So it's kind of a win-win for the company if things go well. And what we're providing is exclusively senior secured loans. So we're looking for companies that typically have the characteristics I mentioned, pretty significant in size and what they've raised from tier one investors. And the type of loan that we're lending in is really intended to take a charge over the company's assets. We intend to be the only lender in that business, certainly at the sort of senior ranking part of the cap structure. And we're looking to make those loans for anywhere from sort of 24 to 30 months. So it's not sort of a 12-month, you know, quick return on capital, but nor is it sort of a 6-7 year hold that you might see in equity. So it's a little bit of that hybrid structure in terms of duration, but you can push returns up to, you know, close to 20% net IRR is what we sort of see in our initial loans that we've given out.
Is that 20% net is inclusive of the warrant upside though as well? What's the income component of that?
Yeah, it's a good question. So when we started looking at the strategy 2 years ago in more detail in a lower interest rate environment, you could sort of underwrite an interest rate payable on each loan, sort of call it 11 to 13%. So you were probably getting about 1,000 basis points over what the effective interest rate was at the time from a central bank perspective. We've seen that just kind of ratchet up. So what we're seeing now is sort of loans going out at anywhere from 15 to 16% on average. The most recent loan that we're doing, 17.5% interest rate. What we typically see is a portion of upfront fees and back-end fees. And what's interesting is that the back-end fees for us, we sort of forecast to be fairly modest. But what we're actually achieving is the ability to often charge anywhere from sort of you know, call it 5 to 10% additional of the loan value. And the way we're able to achieve that is by sort of highlighting that if we're taking 20% of the loan in warrants, it's cheaper for you just to cancel the warrants and give us just a set fee at the end of it. So all of the returns that I'm talking about are really sort of almost fixed income in terms of they're predetermined. If we saw the warrants have substantial value, you know, the share price increased by 2, 3, 4x as an equity investor might hope for in a similar period, then you would achieve well in excess of 20% net.
The deals, I'm assuming they're priced differently depending on the risk. And like in the instance of some tech companies, they may not have many physical assets at all. Do you do many deals like that? And if so, what do you then secure your interest against, or what gives you comfort for a business like that?
It's probably the number one question that we get in terms of the strategy that we run. And so the way to think about the sort of credit underwrite is a little bit different to a traditional asset-backed sort of credit deal. You're right in the sense that there's probably limited sort of secured assets. There might be inventory holdings and whatnot, but they're not going to be of, you know, $50, $100 million worth like you might have in a more traditional business. These businesses are intended to be asset light. They're intended to scale. And so the way that we look at sort of the underwriting is really based on three parameters. The first is we are sitting ahead of all other equity investors, which by the time that we're coming in have probably already started to realize very material gains on their investment. And we're not talking about a sort of small seed fund that might have put $1 million in that's now worth $50 million. These are typically funds that have put $30, $40, $50 million into an asset that might now be worth on paper $100, $150 million their position. And even for a very large private equity fund, that's a meaningful enough ticket that you're not going to just walk away from a transaction or a deal if things go poorly. So what we're really looking at is, firstly, what are the investors that are currently in the company, and what is their ability to follow on and support the business at a time when we are, if it was to get into trouble. The second is it's important to think about the valuation and where the company is at vis-a-vis a total write-off. And so we're typically coming in when a company's worth anywhere from sort of $250 to probably $1 billion plus. There's an awful lot that has to go wrong for investors to simply not put another dollar in. I mean, you could go raise down rounds, you could go raise convertible debt, you could go raise a whole range of financing at a lower than what the peak valuation was, and we're still going to get fully paid out. So understanding the unit economics of the business is really important, because what we're really underwriting is the company able to repay the loan in the next 24 months off of existing cash reserves, or the prospect of either exiting or raising additional cash? And that comes to that third point, which is we're not really in the business of giving out loans that some would call bridge financing, which is sort of inherently higher risk. You know, you're often the only financier coming in. Instead, you're looking at our sort of view is we're typically coming in as equity's being raised. And so the structure of our loans is that they're amortizing from day one. So if you think about it, we're actually able to get sort of repaid through the life of the loan, such that if we got to a point where really there was a really catastrophic outcome, you know, a company was just going to get sold for cents on the dollar, you would still have the ability to probably have been repaid the vast majority of your principal. And, you know, you'd be betting that the company that was worth $500 million can get sold for $5 million, which is probably the residual outstanding. Yeah. So I think those are the types of parameters that help protect us a bit uniquely in this asset class against, the idea of sort of a principal default versus, you know, a sort of LVR on sort of an asset-backed loan.
Can you just go through some of the key advantages for startups in using venture debt over the other sources of finance?
I think what we're commonly seeing is there's three reasons why companies explore venture debt or growth credit. The first is commonly they'll raise a round of equity and then say they raise $40 million. And within sort of 3 to 6 months, they start to invest that capital and they're kind of hitting all their milestones and maybe things are actually going better than expected. If they go back out to the equity markets, including their own investors, they're going to get the exact same share price that they got 3, 6 months ago because not enough time has passed. And so often when our credit team's getting called, you know, the sort of message from the founder is, look, things are going better than expected. But if I go back to my existing investors who are keen to put more money in, they're going to give me the same sort of valuation. And that sort of feels a little bit unfair. So it's an opportunity to kind of top up and not need to go out and sort of raise a whole new round. And raising a new round in the private markets is not a straightforward endeavor. You're opening up the shareholders agreement. You've got sort of a, you know, full share purchase agreement. ongoing due diligence. And so it's not something that you can do in a couple of weeks. You know, whilst we can't do that either, we can typically move with a little bit more agility than a whole new equity round coming together. The second is what we're commonly seeing now is companies thought that the next round they were going to raise at might have been at $500 million valuation. And whilst there's still a lot of interest, it's coming at $400 million. And so they still want the $60 million or $150 million they were going to raise, but they don't want to take more dilution than they thought they were going to have to. And so for them, it's a really good way to be able to get the full value of what you want to go and execute without having to suffer that full dilution now that valuations have re-rated in between, you know, financing rounds particularly. And then the third is that we're increasingly seeing companies that are sort of operating from a position of strength, have a deep balance sheet, think about inorganic growth, particularly as smaller peers of theirs or adjacent sort of operators in categories are subscale, but are very interesting sort of M&A targets. And so it's a way for them to start to leverage debt to be able to build leverage into the balance sheet and acquire businesses that are going to be value accretive for shareholders. And so there's a whole raft of reasons, but those are probably the three most common that we're approached by.
We've spoken about it broadly, but can we put it in a nice little bow? What sets January Capital apart from other venture debt funds in the industry? And are there any specific sectors that you focus at or you're better at than others? Or is it just a broad stroke?
It's a good question. So I think there's three things that we believe that we're doing a little bit differently to most managers that operate in private markets generally in our sort of geographies. The first is we're very data-driven, and a lot of firms say that. So what does that actually mean? We've built two of our own proprietary platforms. So we have an in-house data science and engineering team that's 5 FTEs today. The first platform that we've built, which we actually spun out and now has 30 FTEs, is a platform called Venture Cap Insights. And what we've done there is we've built out a platform that allows us to tap into government company registries. So think ASIC and the equivalent across 8 different markets in this region, where we can pull tens of thousands of regulatory filings per day. And we're able to reconstruct cap tables in certain jurisdictions, audited financials and share prices for almost every sponsor-backed company. So any company that's raised private equity financing or venture capital, we typically can cover. And so that's a really interesting platform because it sort of functions like a private markets Bloomberg. And we've actually gone and commercialized that for two reasons I'll come to. We sell that to the likes of large sovereign wealth funds, so GIC, Temasek, to global venture capital firms like Sequoia Capital or Accel Partners, as well as sort of global buyout firms like KKR or General Atlantic. And so they're buying the data from us and paying us not an insignificant amount of money per year to access that platform. The reason we've commercialized twofold, one, it's really important in private markets to have very deep relationships with co-investors and sources of deal flow. And in the credit space in particular, where you're looking to build what is ultimately a fairly nascent asset class, having a deep level of trust with equity holders is important because you could objectively look at it from an equity holder standpoint and say, well, this is going to be someone that's effectively got the keys to the house on a very important asset of mine. And so by being really in the flow with, you know, over 300 plus firms, we've got that ability to, I think, have built a very deep relationship with them. The second is that whilst that data is useful in the way that we sort of sell it, we do a lot of other things that we don't fully sort of put on the platform that give us an edge in different categories of investment. And the second platform that we've built is what we call First Signal. And what we're looking for there is to unearth the best founders or teams at the earliest stage. So what we're doing is we're tracking a very broad universe of individuals and companies and looking for signals, as we call it, that they're incorporating and starting a company, registering a business at the very early stage, have raised capital in the last 12 months. We kind of can estimate their burn rates and so when they might go back out to raise more in the case of credit, to really allow us to get to founders ahead of the traditional fundraising process where a founder's going out to 15, 20 firms and there's really no proprietary deal flow at that point. So what we're looking to do is get to founders first 3, 6, 12 months ahead of a fundraising round. The second differentiating point, which I'll quickly touch on, is being thematic. So we don't invest in everything. For us, it comes back to that idea of investing to pick and shovel. So across everything that we've done, close to 100% is B2B only. Whilst we have a lot of respect for investors that look at discretionary and consumer investments, I think we don't feel like we're best placed to do that. And there's frankly less competition in the B2B space. And so for us, We've built up a lot of expertise, both on the sort of traditional software side, but also now sort of increasingly across a broad range of sort of B2B industries in the geographies in which we're investing.
And just on the geographies, where are you seeing most of your deal flow come from? And just coming from Australia, obviously you have a particular interest in how Australian founders rank in the Asia Pacific region. Do you think we bat above our weight?
Yeah, absolutely. I think what Australian founders in particular in the last decade have proven out that's relevant to us is you can really scale a software company from anywhere. And I think that recognition, which Indian founders have also done a tremendous job of, I think in the last 5 or 6 years, has given a lot of merit to a lot of the types of businesses we're investing into now, where, you know, if you cast your mind back a decade ago, the sort of idea was, well, as soon as you raise any form of venture capital funding in Australia, you have to go put a VP of sales on the ground in San Francisco to be able to sell into North America. You have to flip the company to a Delaware C corporation, all of these, you know, things. And that's not the case. Like, we're seeing Australian founders that we've backed, as well as Southeast Asian founders, you know, reach a $10, $20 million revenue run rate and not have any meaningful presence from a sort of headcount perspective. Why is that? One, just I think people are a lot more comfortable procuring and buying software digitally now. But two, the way that you typically market your products lean more to product-led growth and sort of open source software. And so again, that really globalizes the opportunity. So to answer your question, I think Australian founders have been a tremendous sort of at providing a beacon of hope that B2B software investing in this part of the world in the Asia Pacific region can generate very compelling returns. For us, source of deal flow, we really try to be pan Southeast Asia. So we're not looking to over-index into any one geography. And the reason behind that's twofold. One, we just don't believe that geography is a moat long-term. If you cast your mind back 15 years in the North American venture cycle, people were like, I only do Boston-based companies. Like, that's all I do. And that's all I'm ever going to do. And a lot of those firms that stuck to that knitting haven't sort of grown into sort of a national venture capital firm and are probably eaten up by the very large players that now raise, you know, $10 plus billion funds in that country. And secondly, you know, we are still fundamentally investing into emerging markets. And so what we don't want to have is any sort of macro level exposure to regulatory or government level sort of changes that might sort of completely wipe out a particular category of investment. And so if you break it down, our target sort of, which we've pretty much adhered to, Indonesia is the largest market from a population and ecosystem sophistication standpoint. Roughly about 25% of any fund's capital will go into that. And then sort of another 30% will go into a mix of Philippines, Vietnam, Thailand. We will put a meaningful percentage, say 10 to 15% to Singapore companies that are actually sort of operating a HQ in Singapore and selling, you know, regionally or globally. And then the residual is selectively looking at markets like India or Australia when we're looking at themes we really deeply understand and we get to co-invest with leading firms in those jurisdictions. What I would say is a question we often get is like, how do you protect against that risk of investing in emerging markets? We aren't deploying the local companies in Indonesia. So about 95% of the deals that we do are typically Singapore domiciled businesses. If they operate in Australia, they might be Australian businesses. Or if they've got exposure to the US, they'll be sort of Delaware C's. And so we're really only investing into sort of Western rule of law. And then obviously the money flows down into operating subsidiaries in different jurisdictions.
That was going to be one of my questions just around the currency risk. And obviously you're lending, so you don't have that much of a currency risk. But what about for their company, say if you're someone's currency halved, which can happen in emerging markets, and their debt doubles and your analysis has been done in the local currency? Is that something that you're taking to account?
Yeah, it absolutely is. What I would say is by the time that we're investing into these companies, they've got fairly sophisticated finance functions. Like, they'll have a chief financial officer often in preparation for a listing or an exit, so quite experienced. They will be, I'd say, fairly sophisticated around transfer pricing and sort of how they think about their treasury function. And what we typically find is that they drip feed individual operating entities in different jurisdictions, and sort of, you know, most of the cash will sit in sort of a USD bank account. Now, there's always that risk to your point that, you know, you can keep drip feeding, but if the currency's halved, you're going to be in a bit of a difficult position. I think that whilst there's been volatility, most currencies globally have experienced sort of an equivalent level of volatility against the USD in the last 2 years. So I think it's not as pronounced as we would have historically seen, but I would say that we're working carefully to assess the sophistication of a finance function within that organization and their ability to appropriately hedge so that they don't find themselves caught short as well. So we're doing due diligence on that level rather than maybe assessing where a currency is going to be in 12 months' time, because, you know, if we knew that, we should probably be doing something else. Yeah.
Could you share some advice for founders who are considering venture debt as part of their financing strategy? What should they keep in mind when approaching someone like yourself?
It sort of applies to both the investors in the company and the founders themselves. The first is there's got to be a good use for it. Like, just raising venture debt because it's available to you is probably not the way to think about that instrument. It's really about, hey, I've got a need, whether it's to give myself a bit more time to get to a next inflection point to raise at a much higher valuation in terms of equity, whether it's to acquire a business that I found really interesting that would be additive or sort of a new growth trajectory, then that would be a reason to do it. The second is to be very thoughtful of the partner that you're working with. I think what we've been able to do, which has been a benefit of us being multi-strategy, is we are also an equity investor. And so we've got that ability to, I'd say, endear ourselves to founders and to investors to say, hey, look, we understand your concerns. We've got 50 companies where we've got equity exposure. And so I think we, whilst we're assessing a company from a credit risk standpoint, it's ultimately got to be in partnership, because not everything's going to go right every single quarter. And so as long as you're very much on top of the detail and you're well ahead of any risks that are emerging, you've got to think about it in partnership. And I think sometimes lenders in this part of the market adopt a very traditional view, which can be actually self-defeatist in some respects, because not everything goes up and to the right in private markets, but it's assessing what's recoverable and what's going to be sort of a path to get back on that trajectory versus, no, we've got a real problem here. And then the third is to not take on more than you need, right? Again, this is not, you know, a zero interest rate environment. And so it's really about knowing what you need it for and how much you need means that founders are, you know, going to be able to service that effectively.
With the typical model of venture capital, a lot of venture capitalist firms will like to take a seat on the board and introduce their contacts and try and actively increase the revenues of that business. Do you share that same dynamic on the venture debt side? So I'm not calling it the right thing in my capital there. Yeah.
That's all right. No, I get your question. I think we're not in the business of maybe adopting the same operator mindset as an equity investor would, in the sense that by the time we're coming in on the venture debt side, the team there want to make sure that it's kind of a self-sustaining business largely, right? And so hopefully anything that we could do in terms of customer introductions, whatever, is not going to be that meaningful because it's already at scale. Now, we'll always try and be helpful, but I think the three things that we've found that we can offer is, one, we really help companies get their reporting in shape. So the demands that, you know, a credit investor will have versus an equity investor is far more pronounced in terms of the frequency of when they need data, the depth of that data, and the integrity or fidelity of that data. And so we can work with companies to really tighten that up. And if they've got public market ambitions or an exit ambition, which most companies have to, that have been sponsor-backed, I think they find that a very helpful experience just to continue to institutionalize their finance function. The second is we're not taking a board seat, but because of the frequency of which we're receiving data, we find often we actually get ahead of even what a board would typically know. Like, we're almost getting down to the operating level of metrics. And then the third is that we have a fairly important impact focus. We're not an impact investor, but responsible investing is quite close to what we do because we are investing into emerging markets. And I think the three sort of, or two things that we see really an opportunity to continue to think about is, one, leveraging the fact that we're this senior secured lender that has covenants and an appropriate level of protection that a credit investor would expect. We can also really make sure and founders are thinking about doing the right thing around gender diversity, around sort of shaping up policies and procedures to get the right governance and sort of diversity in their business, because that's going to be critically important for an exit as well. Yeah. And so I think that's something that we've actually kind of stumbled across in the last 18 months, where we'd meet tremendous teams, good governance, but not probably at a scale that you'd say was IPO ready. Or, you know, you'd go, you know, talk to us about your gender diversity policy, and they'd say, what's that? Yeah. And so, and that's not because they're not thinking about it. It's just that they're so busy doing so many things that until someone actually says, hey, why don't we go focus on this? And we've got precedent documents and things that we can help you with to accelerate your understanding of what's best practice. That's all they need, and that push helps them really kind of, you know, enhance that.
What are your thoughts on the current state of capital markets? Do you think banks will ever get back and compete for your space? Probably unlikely, is suspect what you're going to say. But like, I know a lot of companies, a lot of startups finding it really hard to get funding at the moment.
Yeah.
More so the last 18 months. I think it's getting better, but what are you seeing?
Look, I think we have still quite a bit to shake out in the sort of technology ecosystem. I think if you put your mind in sort of a founder's shoes, they were inundated with capital in 2020 and 2021. And even if you were the most thoughtful founder and didn't raise more than you were offered, you probably still would always raise 24 to 36 months.
Yeah.
And so you're really only starting to see, I think, quite a bit of the pain coming out, where companies that raised maybe anywhere from 3 to 10x their appropriate valuation are having to go back to market. What I would say, though, is that the pain points that we're observing is most pronounced at companies that had raised what we would call a Series A. So typically sort of $5 to $7 million, they had some degree of revenue, but they were still finding what we would call product market fit, but more so go-to-market fit, like a repeatable sales engine, that are now going out to raise what we'd call a Series B or an early growth equity round. And what happens between those two rounds, and this is true even outside of today's market conditions, is you go from being more of a narrative storyteller as a founder, like this is the future, this is the mission, this is where we're going, to really having to show meaningful metrics.
Yeah.
And I think that's the type of transition that founders are finding particularly hard today, because the bar's gone up quite a lot. Mm-hmm. The valuations have come down and the market's hard to sell into generally. And so I think that has sort of caused a bit of a storm for certain folks. The top quartile is still getting funded. And I'd say that's true across all stages. Where we invest on the equity side, which is very early stage, pre-seed, seed, we didn't really see a huge acceleration during COVID, and nor have we seen a huge tailing off in terms of valuations or deal frequency. That's, I think, because that part of the market doesn't have so much capital playing after deals, and it just sort of runs along at sort of a consistent rate. It's just whoever's founding a business, which is great. And then on the credit side, we are still seeing deals. So if you look at our proprietary data in the first half of this year, there was about $2.5 billion of what we would say Series B, Series C, Series D transactions closed. Now, that's down from a peak of, say, $4 billion, but it's still up nearly 2x from pre-COVID. So I think sometimes there's this sort of recency bias where people are like, oh, wow, you know, things have tailed off so much year on year. But if you extrapolate that out to how things were in 2019 in this region, we're still much better off. There's still a lot of capital around. So, but it's not an easy environment for sure.
Can you just give us a bit of an idea of the terms of this particular fund? So lock-in, minimum investments, how Australians can invest?
We're pretty flexible on minimum investment. The reason for that is we've set up an Australian-based feeder structure. We're fortunate to work with a number of sort of wealth manager clients that have been a very important part of our business as we've grown. That can open up this opportunity then to a sort of a broader range of their underlying clients that they work with. So we've tried to keep minimum investments pretty modest, and we look at it more through the relationship that we hold with a particular wealth management firm. In terms of the terms, I think for us, what we look at it as is it's an Australian feeder into a unit trust. It's a very standard fee structure. There's a management fee and a performance fee that's only payable after investors have received 100% of their capital back, plus an 8% preferred return. Pretty standard. It's a 12-month lockup, and then after that, we offer quarterly liquidity on sort of a rolling basis. And the way to think about the sort of cash flow cycle of the fund is we plan to call capital over the first 2.5 years, which is really the investment period of the fund. and you're receiving over the life of that sort of a target yield of anywhere from sort of, you know, 10 to 12% plus. So that by the sort of end of the third year, you've already made back a sort of a reasonable return. From the end of the third year, 100% of all loans that are realized flow back to the underlying investor. So that by midway through the fourth year, you're fully paid up. You've received 100% of your principal capital back. And then you continue to receive, you know, positive return and income until the sixth year of the fund when it's fully wound up. So what we say to investors is think of it as your net dollar is really only outstanding for a relatively short period of time, about a year and a half, 2 years. And you've got the ability to sort of redeem and sort of, you know, generate early liquidity should you need it. And I think that's what's demanded for in today's market. And we're able to offer that because the underlying loans are relatively short dated and we're obviously generating a cash yield or, you know, interest rate on every facility that we're drawing down on.
There was a slide in your deck that said what you expect first for what's actually been achieved historically. And I think you advertised kind of 10 to 13% income payments, but the actual was about 300 basis points higher. Compliance team probably won't let you speak about this, but was that right? Was that the what's happened?
Yeah, I think what we're seeing, and you know, we've started to get some decent data on this, is you can sort of benchmark what we're getting at about 1,100 basis, between 1,000 and 1,200 basis points, probably midpoint of 1,100 above whatever the RBA rate is.
Yeah.
So we're finding that, you know, companies are willing to, if they were willing to pay 10 to 12% in a zero interest rate environment, they're probably willing to pay now anywhere from sort of, you know, call it circa 14 to 17, 18% in today's environment. And so because we just pay out everything that we receive net of a management fee to investors, they're the beneficiary of that in what we observe. So, you know, we sort of think of it as a little bit of an all-weather in the sense that, you know, if it was a zero interest rate environment and we could tell you that you could make 10 to 12%, I think a lot of investors hopefully would feel like that's a pretty interesting risk sort of reward, risk return. And now that we've sort of seen base rates creep up, we're not seeing the sort of you know, overage in terms of what we can generate from an outperformance standpoint shrink. It's just kind of remaining stable. It's just creeping up. Now, there was a natural ceiling. Like if we went out, say if interest rates got back to where they were 40 years ago and, you know, bank rates were at 15%, I don't know if we'd be charging 25% to companies. But at this current range, we can still see a lot of the growth stage companies we're looking at comfortably service that type of loan interest rate.
That's really interesting. Was there any final message you wanted to deliver to the listeners or anything else you don't think that we've covered?
Look, I think the one thing that we always like to say is Southeast Asia, I think people are still educating themselves on in terms of the investment opportunity generally. The thing that we always like to highlight is we're really 10 years into that digital transformation journey. It's a $100 billion GMV market, gross merchandising volume market today. And it's the fastest growing set of economies in terms of the internet economy, faster growing than India or China today. Most forecasts peg it have been $1 trillion. And I think for us, given we're pretty boutique in what we tend to do, it's just about capturing a very small fraction of that. We think that we can really sort of find and unearth compelling opportunities. And so being that access point to investors that say, hey, we like those tailwinds, but we want to do it based on our risk sort of duration profile, that's the ambition of what we're looking to do. So I think if there is interest in the underlying sort of macro tailwinds that we see, then hopefully, you know, there's an opportunity for us to be that point of access for investors.
That's great. Well, I certainly know that I've got a lot of out of the discussion today and really interesting stuff that you're doing. So I really appreciate your time. And if anyone would like to learn more about the strategy, then feel free to reach out to myself or anyone of our team, or reach out to Ben directly, or we can put you in touch. But thank you very much for your time.
Thanks as well, Tim. Really enjoyed the conversation. Cheers.